Chapter 3.
The early period of recording the third series of Red Dwarf was a difficult time for me, because I was already committed to performing in a new play I had co-written. Again, this play was to be premiered at the Edinburgh Festival 1989. The play was called Onan. It was an idea which had been knocking around in my head for a long, long time, and it finally came to fruition when I co-wrote it with actor and writer John Mackay. Onan was the story of two men who set up the first non-sexist, non-racist, write-on pornographic magazine. Yeah. The magazine was called Onan, named after the biblical figure who spilled his seed on the ground. I discovered that you can say spilled his seed on radio and television in interviews. However, if you say wanker, people seem to get upset. Funny old world, isn't it? Anyway, the play dealt with all the thorny issues surrounding the production and consumption of pornography. But it dealt with them in a humorous and witty way. We hoped. When I wasn't doing read-throughs and costume fittings for Red Dwarf, I was busy rehearsing Onan in an old school building in Hackney. John and I both appeared in the play, and our first night tryout took place in the Soho Poly Theatre in London. Considering it was a comedy, the laughs were few and far between. It felt very leaden and worthy. The big audience was crammed into their seats in this tiny basement theatre. Afterwards, John and I were both fairly depressed. We had both had successful shows the previous year in Edinburgh. Now we were going up with what felt like a bit of a dog. Everyone who saw the show in London was very nice about it. It's fantastic, guys. It really says a lot, says someone who looked faintly bored. I really laughed, said someone without cracking a smile. We were also in a bit of trouble, because in the normal course of events, we'd have had time to jiggle the play around a bit, between the first performance and our arrival in Edinburgh. Now, due to my filming schedule, this wasn't possible. The day after this glamour-free premiere, I drove to Liverpool and checked in at the hotel. I was greeted in the bar by the full complement of Red Dwarf. The sound men, the cameramen, the vision mixers, the lighting technicians, boom operators, Rob and Doug. The whole lot of us took over the bar of the hotel. Craig walked in and was greeted at every table as he passed. Everyone in Liverpool knew Craig. He implied to me that half the people who knew him also wanted to kill him, so I moved myself slightly further away. We all went out for a meal, which, considering there was about 80 people in all, took hours of careful organisation. Craig and Danny went off clubbing. I had to go to bed. This is the story of my life. Everyone else goes off clubbing, I go to bed. The reason I went to bed was made apparent in the dark hours of early morning. My bedside phone went. I answered it. A Liverpudlian woman's voice said, "This is your early morning call, Mr. Llewellyn." It had started. This was my first day proper on Red Dwarf. Half an hour later, I was sitting in a makeup chair in the temporary BBC Liverpool studios, which were on the site of the Liverpool Garden Festival, which was on the site of the old docks, which was on the site of the older docks, which was on the site of, probably, a forest. Nothing is permanent on Earth. Nothing can be conserved. Change is the only constant. There we go. That's the sort of paper-thin philosophy I filled my head with as I sat watching Bethan, Jones and Jill put my makeup on. This first day, I was sitting in the makeup chair for something like 6 hours. They were trying it out, testing different colours and powders, painting the mask once it was stuck on me. I'll say it just once because it's boring. But the masks are extremely uncomfortable to wear. It's hard to describe, and I've tried to do it many times. I've said things like, "It's like wearing someone else's old socks over your face all day, with a local anaesthetic, like the dentist gives you, and then sitting in a sauna. It's also like having mud slapped on your face and then dried so it goes all tight. What it's really like is having your whole head covered with prosthetic foam rubber. There is no way of knowing without doing it. It is hot, it is uncomfortable, it does make me a bit irritable. In fact, I'm a bit irritable now. Just writing about it. Just leave me alone, will you? Just don't stand so close. Get off my case. Jesus!" Okay, there, that's it. I'll really try not to go on about the mask. It may pop up occasionally, but I'll try and keep it to a minimum. It's that first day. I'll never forget it as long as I live. The irony warning light was on red alert. 6 hours in makeup. I finally stood up and stretched the stretch of the undead. I had a hyper stretch. My buttocks were as numb as a monk's trouser snake, as they say in Australia. I went into the costume department and was met by the lanky form of Howard Burden, the genius behind all the Red Dwarf costumes. I have to admit, there have been times, maybe as a shard of fibreglass has wormed its way into my anatomy, or my shoulders have ached because of the armour I'm wearing, or when my core body temperature has gone so high I've seen Russian helicopters hovering over me, ready to pour sand on my head, I have been known to call Howard things other than a genius. But it's all done with great love and understanding, because what you see works very well. And as we troopers in showbiz always say, that's what's important. Actually, that's bull. What we really say is, I really can't work in this cosy, love. It is sheer agony. On the first day, I got zipped, buckled, popped, riveted and velcroed and strapped into my costume. For 3 or 4 minutes, it's very comfortable. Then I try and sit down and my plastizote buttocks come flying off. I walked around in it for a while, visited the set where Craig was filming. It was incredible. The remains of a crashed spaceship could be seen stranded on top of an iceberg. It was all made of polystyrene and bits of old cardboard, but it looked great. They were filming the inserts for the episode titled Marooned. Craig was stumbling about in the snow being buffeted by a howling blizzard. This was created by an old Volkswagen car engine on a stand, attached to a giant propeller. It can create enough wind to literally blow you off your feet. It worked. Craig went flying very effectively. He was only too willing to do his own stunts. "Hey, Ed, how about I come out the door and dive out," said Craig, wiping the snowflakes from his hair. "You know, and like, land on me head. That'd look good." "Yes," said Ed brightly, "and you'd also be dead, which would leave me looking like a right wally." "Hey, Eddie man," said Craig. "I can land on me head and no harm done. I'm a Scouser man, you know what I'm saying there?" "Yes, I know exactly what you're saying, and you are completely mad." Just as the wind machine was getting ready to blow Craig through the supporting wall of the studio, lunch was called. Another bit of standard Red Dwarf irony. I had spent 6.5 hours getting ready, and then I had to sit still for an hour and do nothing while everyone had lunch. I don't blame people for having lunch. I think it is their most fundamental human right to have lunch. It's just ironic, or sod's law, that it always seems to happen that I am just ready to work just before lunch. I went into the porter cabin that was my dressing room and sat down and looked in the mirror. The mask was extraordinary. It was impossible to see where the mask stopped and my face began. I looked at myself for a long time. That moment was the one and only time I was terrified of Crichton. It was the shock of being alone, looking in a mirror and not seeing yourself looking back. Someone else, some square-headed dork with chiselled features, was looking back at me. I looked closer. It was someone else. It wasn't me there. My heart rate went off the scale. I felt dizzy and nauseous. I felt as if someone had spiked my tea with a harsh hallucinogenic drug. I was, as they say in Australia, off my face. I looked away from the mirror and tried to compose my thoughts. I really felt like I was going mad. I was really very scared. I had to get away from the mirror, but the movement of my standing caught my eye in the mirror again, and I looked back. There he was, that bloke with no hair and a cuboid head. It was horrible. I walked out of the porter cabin, through the makeshift dining area, and into the parking lot outside. I walked past people who were working on the show, technicians and office staff, and they all ignored me. They had no idea. I just had the fright of my life. They couldn't tell if I was happy or sad or angry or upset or scared even. To them, I was the poor sod in the rubber mask. It made me super aware of how much we can give away with our faces when we think people won't notice. We are all, unconsciously most of the time, very good at reading people's faces. We can usually tell at a glance what sort of mood someone we know is in. If you remove that element, people start to cut you off, start to remove you from their mind's eye, take less notice of you. Is this what it's like being disabled or having a terrible facial disfigurement? You wander through a world where you are very aware that you're being cut out of the picture. When I was about 15, I visited the Museum of Mankind in London with my mum, and I saw a man who was also looking at the exhibition who had a hole in the side of his face the size of an orange. You could see the side of his jaw, his teeth, his tongue. The poor man must have suffered some terrible accident or had commando surgery for cancer. Whatever it was, the result was very shocking. I was torn, as I'm sure most people would be, and I tried not to look at him. I wanted to stare, but I'd been taught that staring was rude, so I looked away. I don't know what to do in a situation like that. Whatever your reaction is, it's wrong.
Crétin, said a voice with a French accent. Do you want a cup of tea, Crétin?
It was Sylvie, the production runner. She was a very small French woman who could not pronounce the name Crichton and settled on Crétin, which means the same in French as it does in English. She looked me in the eye when she asked me if I wanted tea. Then she gently reached up and touched my rubber face.
It must be very hot, she said.
I nodded. It was very hot. I'd only been in it 7 hours and I was parched. It was interesting, however, that some people were not at all intimidated by the mask, and some were so horrified that they looked away. Sylvie's radio crackled into life, asking her to go into the studio. She replied,
I am making tea for Crétin,
which meant the whole crew heard her call me Crétin. It was naturally only a matter of time before the rest of the cast were also calling me Crétin, especially Danny, who found it peculiarly amusing. Danny's laugh could easily win the International Full-Bodied Laugh Grand Prix. I got a cup of tea from Sylvie, and then I found I couldn't drink it. It was like trying to drink after you've been to the dentist and your lips are completely numb. I couldn't feel my own lips, but immediately the tea touched my prosthetic lips, they absorbed the fluid, and it tasted like I was sucking someone else's flannel in the bath. Did you ever do that as a kid? Suck your flannel? I did. My mum was always telling me not to suck my flannel, but at least it was my own flannel. I've got no idea why I did it. But imagine doing that, thinking it was your flannel and feeling quite happy about it, and then realising it was someone else's flannel and you knew they had just washed their bottom department with it. Lunch was supplied by location caterers, my favourite form of eating ever. I will often agree to do a job if I hear the production is being made on location. It means one of those big trucks will be there with the two men inside who serve amazing food in the middle of nowhere. Here's a tip. If you see a film crew near your street, try and beg, borrow or steal a windproof jacket, a peaked cap with the name of a TV show or film on the front, and join the queue. The food is free and very nice. If anyone asks who you are, which is very doubtful, tell them you're from a company with a TV-type name. Teletechno, Telegraphic, TV-mazing, something like that. And you're on set to talk to Nick. There's always a technician called Nick on every crew. I've done this many times around North London. Of course, it does help if you know one of the lighting or sound people, but I've managed to get a free lunch from location productions where I didn't know a soul. There was a long queue leading up to the step of the location catering truck. I was salivating. I'd missed breakfast. I'd been sitting still for hours. My body was pleading with me for some form of low-level pleasure. Food, anything, an old carrot, just something different to the stifling tightness. I chose the roast beef with the cauliflower, peas and roast potatoes. I made my way from the truck to the double-decker bus, which serves as a dining room. I sat down and looked at this plate of food. How on earth was I going to get it in my mouth? I chopped everything up small and tried to get it past my lips without touching them. My prosthetic lips tasted so horrible by now, I didn't want them to spoil my lunch. I soon found that by tipping my head backwards, I could more or less drop food into my open mouth from above. After I'd done this a few times, I looked up and saw Craig looking at me sympathetically. Oh, you poor sod, he said. I did feel pretty miserable. I stopped eating before I finished my plate and stared at what remained sadly.
Crétin, they want you in wardrobe, said Sylvie.
So that was it. I couldn't really eat. After slipping into my costume, I use the term slipping in a comedy way, I had to go to makeup again to be touched up before going on the set.
You've ruined your lips, said
Bethan Jones, viewing the damage all that tea and roast beef had done. I was there another 30 minutes being re-glued, repaired and powdered, then finally I entered the studio to do my first shot for Red Dwarf. In the story, the cat was out searching for Lister and Rimmer on Starbug, which had crash-landed and was marooned on an ice planet. The cat had harnessed Crichton to a sledge, and the scene demanded that I pull this sledge, with Danny and a load of provisions, across a snowy landscape in a blizzard. He had to shout, "Mush! Mush!" as if I were a pack of dogs, and lash me with a bullwhip. He was so excited about it, and kept walking around in circles, cracking the whip very expertly and saying, "Mush! Mush, Crétin! Mush!" I was not so keen. For a start, when I was tied up to the sledge, I couldn't get a grip in all the fake snow. So Peter Rag tied another rope to the sledge and somehow managed to lie down on the floor and pull the sledge for me. That would have been cool, but then they brought around the wind machine, the one they'd been blowing Craig around with in the morning. To get a good blizzard effect, they would start up the wind machine and then pour washing soap flakes into the wind. Not a gentle handful. We are talking buckets of the stuff. Literally buckets. Ed arranged the camera and they started the wind machine. As soon as it was up to full blast, which was deafening, they started the blizzard effect. Within seconds, due to intense eye pain, I realised my eye blink ability was severely restricted. The makeup was so heavy around my eyes that I couldn't really close them. Super painful shards of mild and gentle soap powder stung my forced open eyeballs. I grimaced and tried to cover my face. I couldn't see or hear anything. I finally turned away from the shot and someone killed the wind machine. I looked at Danny through soap vision. He was sitting on the sledge in a big fur coat. He was smiling from cheek to cheek. He was wearing cool, tinted goggles and seemed completely unaware that the wind machine had stopped and everyone was walking around ignoring him. He was still saying, "Mush! Mush, Cretin! Mush!" "No, the shot doesn't work, chaps," said Ed By. Now there's irony for you. For the next hour or so, we tried various different combinations of me pulling the sledge through various mixtures of fake snow. All of these combinations involved Danny sitting on the sledge going, "Mush! Mush!" In the final broadcast version of Marooned, none, I repeat, none of these shots were used. I thought that warranted a special irony warning light on the giant heavenly dashboard. What I didn't see was the upcoming irony klaxon horn, which was warning about the following day. Now, I have promised not to go on about the mask and the heat and the discomfort, and I won't, but this day continues to hold the record for being the most ironic of all. We moved to another hotel in Manchester, a very splendid place called the Midland. Not that I noticed its splendour when I woke up. 5:30 in the morning in Manchester is not a glamorous time. But what is glamour anyway? A fleeting feeling which leaves no trace. No, this had no glamour, sitting in the back of a taxi which smelt strongly of that special taxi air freshener, the sort that's in the little cardboard holder that hangs from the rearview mirror and feels as if it's peeling a layer of skin off your nostrils.
"Telly, is it?"
said the driver. "Yeah, actually, it's a series called Red Dwarf. I play a robot," I said, trying to sound like an actor.
"Never heard of it,"
said the driver. He wiggled his way through the back streets of Manchester and dropped me by the side of the BBC studios on Oxford Road. I stumbled into the BBC building and headed for the canteen. I knew how hungry I was going to get, so I thought I'd better stoke up. The canteen was shut. Irony warning light on orange. I went up to the makeup room and sat down. The process which took place I don't want to describe for two very good reasons. One, it's very boring, and two, it brings it all back as I write it, and I don't have my prosthetic counsellors here to help me. Suffice it to say, 6 hours later, I was laughing and joshing around in the costume department. I got changed into my costume and was then transported by cab to the Midland Hotel, where we were recording in a gym. Irony warning light to darker orange. In the episode called Body Swap, Lister and Rimmer have done a deal whereby Rimmer was allowed to have a go in Lister's body for a while. The scene we were recording was meant to show Rimmer exercising Lister's body by sitting in a jacuzzi, reading a women bodybuilder magazine and smoking a huge cigar. I entered with a huge selection of food for him to gorge himself on. I was then meant to light a candle with a flame coming from my finger and serve the food. Okay, by now the irony warning light was on red, but the klaxon hadn't quite gone off. Had this been a UN peacekeeping force, as opposed to my irony control, the F-111s and stealth bombers would have been in the air, missiles armed and ready. I noticed when I first arrived that the crew were all wearing shorts and t-shirts. Of course, this wasn't a gym. It might be called a gym, but really it was a sports and leisure centre. That meant it was a place where fat businessmen went to shower down and sit around sweating for a bit after a heavy night's drinking. "Morning, Robert." It was Peter Rag standing next to me, holding a glove, a gas bottle and a lot of wires. He started to fit the glove on, run the wires and the gas tube up my sleeve and out behind my head.
"It's just an electric spark cigarette lighter," said Peter. "Bog standard. We'll be back here, and on cue,
we'll fire it up. A flame will come out of the end of your finger. You light the candle and blow the flame on your finger out. Then we turn the gas off.
Great, that's fine, yeah, I said, which is liberals speak for, oh my God, I'm going to die, but I don't want to be rude to this nice man.
Ed Bye was chirpy and happy as usual.
All right, chap, he said.
Bit hot, I said, and then felt guilty for complaining.
It's bloody boiling in here, said Ed. You must be roasting alive in there. This won't take long.
Irony klaxon horn sounding for the first time. Just one blast, but I should have noticed. Craig came in, wearing a pair of swimmers and a dressing gown, looking truly like the Crown Prince of Packet. I suppose I should explain what that could possibly mean. The Crown Prince of Packet. It's an absurd collection of words that makes no sense. Well, the word packet, in this instance, is urban slang for the male genital protuberance. The entire package housed in clothing, which is designed to enhance said offering rather than discreetly disguise it. Craig's wonderful Liverpudlian heritage is made up of four different races: African, Anglo-Saxon, Indian, and Chinese. As Craig has said on many occasions, in public and on stage, he's very grateful that he ended up with a Chinese body and an African cock, not the other way round. He does indeed present a very eye-catching package. Hey, Crikey, you're looking good, man, he said as he shed his dressing gown and dropped into the pool. Craig was immediately in his element, looking at pictures of highly muscled, semi-naked women smoking a cigar and lounging in a warm pool. We went for a take. I had to push a trolley laden with food and not trip up over the wires and tubes strapped to my back. Craig was mouthing his lines. Chris would dub them on later. I had to guess when my cue was by watching his lips. Then I presented the food and went to light the candle. Peter saw his cue and hit the button. A sharp jolt of pain shot up my arm. I jerked. Then there was another.
I'm being electrocuted,
I said, not noticing there was a flame coming out of my finger. I waved this flaming digit around for a moment. It didn't seem to want to go out.
I'm going to die, I thought. I'm going to burst into flames and die. Not while I'm trying to save a family in a burning building, not heroically, but while making a British comedy TV show.
Peter Ragg saved my life by blowing the little flame out. The fact that he saved my life was a mixed blessing, I thought. It meant I was still covered from head to foot in rubber and plastic, standing in a sauna in a Manchester hotel, and we hadn't shot a thing.
Don't worry, chaps, said Ed Bye. It's only a rehearsal.
After they had stripped me down, we worked out that I was sweating so much under my costume that I had shorted out the wires leading to the gas nozzle. We tried the shot 6 or 7 times. Each time I got an electric shock, or the gas didn't light, or I blew my lines because I talked over Craig, or the sound of the jacuzzi was too much. I eventually went a bit dizzy and was taken to the exit, where it was much cooler. I can remember Paul Jackson being there, the man who'd got me this job. He'd come to see how things were going.
How's it going, Robert? He said.
It's fine, I lied. I'm just a bit hot. I think if people could have seen my actual face at the time, I would have been made to lie down. My face would have looked the colour of a baboon's arse. But it was Crichton's face, calm and smooth, kind and sympathetic, in a cuboid novelty condom sort of way. The rest of that day is a bit hazy. What we discovered afterwards was that if a human body sweats that much, you not only lose water, I was drinking 2 big bottles of mineral water a day and not urinating once, but you also start losing essential salts and minerally things. I don't know what happens, but what it means is you feel dizzy and tired and a bit sick. Of course, the final irony of ironies was that none of this footage was ever used. The scene was rewritten and done in a studio. This is the sort of irony where you need to learn breathing exercises and chant little Buddhist mantras to yourself, otherwise you go barking mad. Beth Ann turned up the next day with a box of diarrhea salts that you give little kids in Somalia when they've got the runs. It helps rehydrate them. I felt guilty because I thought I was depriving some poor kid in the desert, which is a classic self-centred middle-class guilt-ridden thing to do. The next 3 days were spent in various locations around Manchester, filming inserts for Backwards. This included Chris Barry and I walking backwards through the Piccadilly shopping arcade dressed as a mechanoid and a hologram, and an unimaginable amount of people utterly failed to notice us. You can see on the footage they used that most of the busy Tuesday morning shoppers were totally oblivious of the fact that they had just walked past 2 men, one who looked a bit like Captain Scarlet with an H stuck on his forehead, the other with a square rubber head and a shiny silver body, who was walking backwards. We had to walk backwards. I didn't understand this at the time, because when the film was run forwards, we would be walking forwards and all the shoppers would be walking backwards.
After one of these long days, I went back to our hotel where we'd done the makeup, got cleaned off, had a shower, and drove to Edinburgh. That was a mistake, because I was utterly exhausted and I couldn't really see. But being a soft southern bastard, I thought, Manchester's in the north, so is Scotland, so Edinburgh can't be far. As I drove for hour after sleepy hour along near deserted A roads across the borders, often driving with my head out of the window to try and keep awake, I realised I was very wrong. I got to the little flat I'd rented in Edinburgh at about 2:30 in the morning to be greeted with tea and toast from John Mackay, my writing partner and co-actor in Onan. He filled me in on the gossip and told me what was happening with our show, which was due to open the following day.